Hello and welcome to Transmission. Today I'm joined by Tom Glover, UK Country Chair for RWE, owners of Britain's largest power generation fleet with enough capacity to supply 12 million homes. Our conversation covers the evolving role of gas generation in a renewables-dominated system, the complexity of a transition to hydrogen or carbon capture and storage, and how we can reinvigorate wind in GB. What caught my attention was his point that despite gas generation falling from a third of UK power generation today to potentially just 5% by 2030, we'll still need roughly the same 35 gigawatts of gas capacity. It's moving from a two-shift workhorse to more like a strategic reserve. As the power system becomes increasingly intermittent and complex, can market mechanisms deliver the coordinated infrastructure that we need? Let's jump in. Hello, Tom, and welcome to Transmission.
Thank you for having me.
So, Tom, who are you and what's your role within GB?
Brilliant. Okay, so I'm Tom Glover. I'm the UK Country Chair for RWE. RWE is one of the UK's leading power generators. We generate enough power for about 12 million homes. We employ about over 3,000 staff in the UK across 80 sites. We've got about 10 gigawatts pro rata of power generation, and that's across all technologies apart from nuclear. Okay. So a major contributor. Myself personally, I've been with RWE for over 21 years. I'm also a board member of I chair our renewables businesses in the UK. I'm a board member of Energy UK. I chair the Carbon Capture and Storage Association. And so I've kind of been around the block in the energy industry. So quite a good view of the whole energy situation in the UK.
I think a huge wealth of experience in energy that's going to be really helpful for our listeners to understand how you're approaching this and your thoughts on some of the topics that we're going to come across today. So just to get straight into it, what is the changing role of gas in the GB power system?
So RWE is the biggest gas generator in the UK, and you know, the role of gas has continuously changed. You know, when we first built these power stations, started building them 20 years ago, these were designed for baseload, all of them two-shift now. So by two-shift, I mean they come up in the morning normally for the peak time and go off in the evening. And the load factors and the amount of energy gas supplies already in the UK is quite low. So gas generation was about a third of the UK's power generation last year. So it's already gone from being, you know, down. And so what we see going forward, if you take the government's plans, so their Clean Power Plan 2030, they forecast that they could get to 5% of generation coming from gas by 2030. So, you know, that's a material reduction in the amount of gas we've got to do. So that role becomes what I like to say, like the fire brigade of the energy system, which is you still need it, but you need it much shorter amounts of time, but you need it to turn up when it's required. Okay. Oh. And if you look at all the plans, actually, you need pretty much the same amount of gigawatts of gas that you've had for the last 10 years. So actually, if you look at all the energy statistics, we've had about 35 gigawatts of gas almost every year. It's been quite flat. And that is effectively forecast to go forward. So we need the same amount of power stations, but basically doing a lot less work. And, you know, and that is quite an evolution in terms of how we're going to manage and operate those going forward.
And that's good news from a carbon perspective, right? So running those stations less means less carbon emitted,
absolutely,
which is ultimately the goal of this. But as someone who runs those stations, there's obviously a commercial business case that's behind the scenes. And if you go from running, say, 30% of the year to running 5% of the year, then the number of hours that you're just generating and making that, say, standard profit on, that's changing. So how do you kind of keep those gas stations having a sustainable business model so they can be that fire engine of the power system?
Yes, I think you've got to think about the different income sources that you get. So what we'll see probably is a much reducing income source from what we call the wholesale markets, and it'll be much more concentrated. So you're talking about some very short periods of very high prices that you need to try and capture, which means the reliability and availability of those power stations needs to increase. And obviously, if you're not there during those periods, your penalty is going to be huge. So there's going to be a lot more focused on short-term reliability. That's kind of like one, but the wholesale element of our income is going to go down. We'll become increasingly reliant on capacity market income. So that's the market that pays us to be available. And also things like ancillary services, so stability, frequency response, etc. So those kind of grid security type products. So we need to kind of change our operations and maintenance strategies and our investment strategies to reflect that very low running, but still all required in that, you know, that that 2 weeks of the Dunkelflaute, as we like to call it, or that period of low wind and low solar. So it's kind of a change for commercially, but actually a really important change technically for the way the power stations are run.
Yeah. And I suppose just on the ancillary service side, I think one of the really interesting things we see is that when we get kind of really negative prices or really low prices, actually it's sometimes the RWE stations, so Pembroke or Staythorpe, are often still running when there's those low prices. And often that can be through things like needing to provide voltage control to the system. Is that the type of thing you're describing as they sort of gear up?
Yeah, absolutely. So when you look at those actions the system operator's taking in the balancing mechanism, so the market used to balance the system, you'll see that some are tagged for transmission reasons rather than for energy reasons. And you do need a certain amount of inertia, frequency response, etc. on the system. Now, of course, the NESO is investing in different technologies to also provide that, whether it's grid-forming batteries or, for example, we're just building at the moment a synchronous condenser down at Pembroke exactly to meet those needs. So rather than always putting on a gas station to do it, we effectively have a big spinning mass that basically will give us that inertia. So there will be different solutions, but when you look at it, and you know, the Committee on Climate Change, the system operator, all kind of modellers do actually see the gas stations are pretty much there for the foreseeable future in terms of capacity. But you're quite right. So the gigawatts need to be there, but the megawatt hours less so. And so from an environmental perspective, it's much better.
Okay. And maybe we've kind of just moved into saying Pembroke without necessarily saying what it is. So could you describe quickly Pembroke for our listeners?
Yes. So Pembroke is our largest CCGT, so combined cycle gas turbine power station down in South Wales in Pembrokeshire. And of course, because it's the end of a very long line with lots of interconnectors, it's quite important for system security. So we've got a project down there that is what we call our Pembroke Net Zero Centre. And so as well as having the gas station, which is, you can argue, is more of the older technology, we're also building a 300 megawatt battery down there. We've got a synchronous condenser down there. We've got plans to do other things like decarbonize that power station. And we've also got a hydrogen project down there. So we're trying to kind of take our, let's call it, I'm going to say old fashioned, but more, you know, the kind of older technology, and then upgrade it to make sure that it's future proof for both future system requirements and future environmental requirements.
Yeah. So if you go from, say, how that site would have run in the teens to how it will run in the future, maybe the gas site's not going to be running as often, but you might have the battery and the synchronous condenser running quite often to keep that grid stability.
Yeah. And it also depends on what technology we do. So I would like to see our sites as kind of a big evolution, right? So many, many years ago, that was an oil-fired power station, right? And then we turned it into a brand new high-technology CCGT. If we don't do anything on a decarbonisation front, you're fully right, the load factor will go down materially. But of course, we also want to look at decarbonising it. So looking at either carbon capture and storage on the back of it or putting hydrogen through the front of it. If we put carbon capture and storage on the back of it, then its load factor may be a bit higher because it's then very low carbon generation. But of course, we're looking at the future. And so we're also looking at, can we provide hydrogen to the local industries? You know, can we provide system services for a cheaper way than a gas station? What are the opportunities for batteries? So I think RWE's strategy is continuing evolving, and we kind of look at the market and say, well, where's the new opportunities? And we'll just keep on evolving our fleet. You know, when I started in the industry, you know, we had a lot of coal stations and a lot of oil stations and not many gas stations, hardly any wind farms, any solar farms. Now, you know, all the coal is closed or the oil is closed. And now, yeah, we've still got majority of our fleet is still gas, but we've got a heck of a lot of renewables now. And I just feel that proportion will just change over time, almost like our portfolio evolving with the overall industry portfolio.
Mm. And maybe before we get on to CCS, because that is where we're definitely going,
yep.
I just want to go back to a comment you made earlier. So this comment around these large gas-fired power stations that you've built that you're expecting to run base load, you're now running in a sort of two-shift pattern, so turning on in the morning, turning on in the evening. As time goes on, that might get a bit more choppy. And from a sort of engineering but also commercial management perspective, does that make things really hard in terms of running those systems? How do you think about the sort of evolving role of those stations?
Yes, I think it becomes hard, much harder in a lot of different ways. So the first thing you've got to do is think about how you're going to invest in that plant going forward. And so for each of our assets, we try and look at the best investment strategy. So we normally look at like decarbonization options. So can we convert them to hydrogen firing or CCS? Or we'll look at, can we do some more outages to keep them running for longer in an unabated fashion? Or, to be honest, do we just keep them as they are and run them to closure, optimizing our hours? Yeah. And each asset is different depending on its current age, its land availability, access to hydrogen pipelines or CCS pipelines. So each asset has effectively a strategy, right? And trying to make that investment within the uncertainty of, do you actually believe the clean power plan is going to get achieved? How many batteries do you think you're going to have on the system? Do you think a hydrogen pipeline is going to turn up? Do you think carbon capture and storage is going to be there? Do you think non-pipeline transport of CO2 is going to be there? These are quite difficult things to decide on how to even invest in the first place. And then once you've got your kind of your, let's call it your power station investment set up, how you optimize it is quite interesting. So as you say, it's going to be quite choppy. So in very high periods of wind and solar, it may be we go for weeks without being needed, maybe even months. Yeah. And then you've got to have a preservation strategy. You can't just leave these systems, you know, full of water. They'll start, you know, rusting and stuff. So you have to preserve them. And then you've got to think, well, it might suddenly need to come out of preservation quite quickly. So how do we get them out to respond? And I said earlier, the value of those periods when they're required are going to be extremely valuable. And not being there is going to be extremely costly. So kind of optimizing that is quite interesting. And then I think the other thing is the way that it works on these turbines is it's a bit like an MOT on your car. You know, you get so much, you get, well, it's actually not like MOT. An MOT is like your annual, it's like a service, right? So you get a number of thousand miles or a number of thousand hours before you have to do your next service. And of course, we can change when those services are required by how many hours we run. So we can fully optimize that and say, well, do we just run it as soon as every time it makes money? Or do we say, actually, the next service is really expensive, so I need a margin before I run to contribute to the next service? So it is a complicated challenge. I must admit that companies like RWE are going to be excellent at it, of course, because I would say that. But we had the same challenge when we went to coal closures. So when we did the coal closures, we ended up with limited hours, limited amounts of coal, limited sulfur buckets, etc. So to be honest, we're really good at doing the optimization. And so it's difficult, but I'm sure we'll rise to the challenge.
And you mentioned one thing in there, which was sort of, you talked about these stations. You said they had like a bucket of hours, I think you described it as. Is that something that you're thinking about spending? So do you know that you've got a certain number of hours you can run for before that station is kind of at end of life?
And no, I think it's a bit more like, I don't know, let's say end of life. I like to use, you know, Trigger's broom.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
It's the same broom, but you replace the handle and the brush. So it's the same power station, but I can replace all the parts, right? So I don't really see an end of life per se. What you have is certain investment choices to make. So roughly every 8,000 hours of running, you've got to do a service. And roughly every 800 starts or 24,000 hours, you've got to do a major outage. And those major so-called C outages, they're called, you know, they can cost somewhere between 15 million to 40 million, depending on the scope per unit. So that's quite a big decision. So the always question is do you do the outage or do you effectively ration your hours? So do you say, well, I don't want to do the outage, I'm running to closure. And in which case you can ration your hours and say, well, I'll just do those hours and then close. But that's the decision. You can always refurbish it and keep on going.
Mm. And it's a really nice kind of a little bit of a segue into kind of how the batteries might be, the battery fleet might work in GB in the future, in that you're trying to optimize for a number of hours and a number of starts. Well, if we have a really quick shortage, say for an hour and a half in the GB system, then it might not make sense to spend one of our starts for the gas fleet to start up. Maybe actually we can lean on the battery fleet to do the very shorter pieces and actually have the gas fleet running for slightly longer.
That's exactly what I would think. I mean, I think at the end of the day, like 0 to 4 hours, assuming we can get grid forming batteries and inertia from other sources, you know, from 0 to 4 hours, why would you ramp up a big complicated bit of gas kit? That doesn't make any sense at all. But, you know, there is going to be periods, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, when you need these things running. And all our modelling shows this. And so then batteries are no good. You know, once you get past your 8 to 10 hours.
Oh, you know? I don't quite agree. And maybe I'll say why. And then you can tell me.
Yeah, yeah.
So the period that you're talking around in terms of, say, a 2 or 3 hour period in a winter, which is very difficult to deal with. So you've got no wind, very low solar. It's winter, so it's high demand as well. And you're absolutely right that you need terawatt hours of generation effectively to get through that period. And I totally agree with you that a battery can't be, say, charging for 3 weeks to discharge for 3 weeks. That's very much not the role of batteries. Yeah. But what they can do is that they can work within days and they can reduce the size of the largest demand peak. And so you can better manage the shape of the demand, which means you might need slightly fewer gas units to get through that 3 week period. Is that an okay amendment?
To some extent, right? So I think the problem is the marginal cost of your gas station isn't really going to change during the day because gas is quite a flat daily product. We have maybe some weekend shift. So basically, as soon as I put a gas station on, the marginal price shouldn't really shift during the day, right? So your optimization of batteries is going to be off whether you buy my gas now at 9 o'clock at night or 4 o'clock at night. So the amount of optimization is limited. And when we look at it, we're talking about periods where you might only be getting 15 to 20% of renewable generation on the system. So something's got to do the 80%, right? And batteries just trimming between, you know, off peak and peak, that will stop me having to two shift my CCGTs, definitely, right? So it means the amount of shifting I have to do, but the amount of actually megawatt hours doesn't actually change over that 2 or 3 week period. In fact, the batteries have got an efficiency, so the number of megawatt hours are on net demand. So, and you know, all the modeling that we've done, all the modeling I see, you still need this 35 gigawatts ish. I mean, 30 to 40 gigawatts is the modeling range, I think. But I think you still need it. And it's particularly for that period that is beyond the batteries, beyond things like pumped storage. You actually just need terawatt hours of energy. And there's not really any other sensible way of doing that.
Yeah. Okay. I think this is a really interesting part of the system. Let's move on from gas and the role of gas to an adjacent part, which is CCS, mm-hmm. Or maybe CCUS, and perhaps you can kind of clarify that for me. But CCS hasn't had the best track record in GB to date, but how is it going to come into the market? How might it change how gas units run?
I think you're talking about a new technology. I'm not going to say an emerging technology because it's well proven now that this is possible to do around the world, but it is not a cheap technology. We have to be really honest with ourselves that this is one of the last things you should be doing on the system, right? You should exhaust all the cheaper options first, and then you should go to CCS and hydrogen. But even if you do that, if you look at all the modeling done by most people, you need, you know, a decent amount of what we call abated technology, right? CCGTs. And most people have 10 gigawatts plus. So out of that 35 gigawatts of gas, we're still saying the majority of it remains unabated, but you need probably about 10 gigawatts. And again, there's modeling inaccuracies depending on your views of nuclear and various other technologies. So you need this technology. And in fact, you need CCS to meet overall climate stuff across industry, right? So in reality, it definitely makes sense in the cement industry. It definitely makes sense in refinery, in the glass and steel sectors. Does it make sense in the power sector? It's definitely the marginal technology. So we should avoid it where possible, but most of the modeling says you need it. So this is stuff that we know is needed, and we know it's definitely needed by 2035, 2040, right? But it takes a long time to develop a business, to develop a business case, to develop storages. So that's why we have this managed process through in the UK. So this is the so-called cluster process, where basically we're trying to develop carbon capture and storage in clusters, and then go wider out in pipelines. And so, yes, it has been slower than we would all like. I don't think it's necessarily a problem, because at the end of the day, we should go slowly with expensive technologies and make sure that we're only doing it where we need to do it. But I mean, this year has been pretty strong for CCS. We've had, you know, the FID, so the financial investment decisions for the two Track 1 clusters. We've had the first FID for a CCGT with CCS up in Teesside. So we can see that now coming. I think there's been a delay in what we call the Track 2. So this is the second lot of clusters in the process, mainly due to lack of government funding and lack of government support. As chair of the CCSA, I can tell you that the industry, the developers who want to get into the industry, the oil and gas players who want to do it, is booming. We're on our highest ever membership, you know, over 100 members of the Carbon Capture and Storage Association. So actually, the ambition for industry and the need is there. We think need government to kind of, particularly under the comprehensive spending review, to make sure there's sufficient money to keep this industry going. And it's a developing industry. So it's not going to, it's like offshore wind in the early stages. Let's go slowly, let's go carefully, but let's keep on going on the track. And you know, it is, there's certain industries that can't do without it.
Okay. And I think there's, in the energy transition, there have been, somebody once described this to me, we've gone from like uncertainty to certainties. And I really like that for certain things. So like, for example, batteries. If you go back to 2014, batteries, bit of a question mark, quite expensive. Would we use them in the grid? Not sure. Now we've delivered so many of them, between 5 and 6 gigs, and we're probably going to be over 30 gigs by the time we get to 2050. We have certainty around how much they cost, how they deliver, how we connect them. From a technical perspective, it's very doable, and we know exactly kind of how they work. I think that the really interesting about CCS is that although it's proven in some parts, I don't yet feel like I have a date in mind for when I see that on a power station in GB, and I can point at it and go, yes, there we go.
I mean, there is a date, because
okay, so
there's the Net Zero Teesside project by BP, which has gone to FID.
Okay.
So, I mean, I don't know their project timelines, but we must be talking 3 or 4 years before you'll see the first one on the system storing CO2. So there is a date, there is a project,
yeah,
and there's lots of projects in development as well. So I am convinced it's going to get there.
Okay, exciting space.
Yep.
Let's move on to a second part of technologies that potentially could change how things operated and operate. And you mentioned CCS on Pembroke, but you also mentioned hydrogen as a sort of feedstock to it. So how do you think about hydrogen's evolution in the GB power market?
Yeah, so in the GB power market, again, it's a last resort type fuel. And I maybe kind of think about hydrogen from two perspectives. I see about hydrogen to power, so using hydrogen as a low carbon fuel source in gas turbines or gas engines. And I also think about it as a flexible demand or a demand source in terms of electrolysis in order to provide hydrogen to industry. So starting with the first, I mean, look, in my view, there's no point putting green hydrogen into a gas station, right? If you actually go through the efficiency of taking wind power, making it into hydrogen, putting it into a gas station and producing power, I'm pretty sure, I hope that batteries will beat it many, many times over, right? So, but that's quite different from maybe blue hydrogen. So the way I kind of like think about it for blue hydrogen versus CCS, blue hydrogen is like pre-combustion CCS, right? So you make blue hydrogen by having carbon capture and storage. Yeah, so it's like pre-combustion CCS, or you capture the carbon after the power station. So that's a little bit like local dynamics, which one makes sense. So if you've got lots of industry wanting hydrogen and you've got some hydrogen stores, it may make economic sense to have blue hydrogen just used in a gas turbine for when peak supply is required, rather than having a dedicated CCS on the back of the power station.
Okay. And just for listeners, blue hydrogen, where does blue hydrogen come from?
So it's basically methane, so old-fashioned gas, put through a process that basically separates that into hydrogen and carbon dioxide for storage.
Okay. And perhaps the same question as the CCS side, which is like, when do you think we'll kind of get hands-on data about that, a scheme like that running in GB?
So blue hydrogen, that's part of the FID that was done for Track 1 in the Northwest. So that will be extremely soon. And it's been done around the world a lot. So that's not a problem. Then I'll maybe talk about green hydrogen a bit and what we do see that useful for. So green hydrogen for demand is, you know, we've had what was called the hydrogen allocation round 1, yeah, which was basically to make green hydrogen electrolysis. So that's making hydrogen via electrolysis. And 125 megawatts of that was successful. So we'll start seeing those projects come online now. We're currently running what's called hydrogen allocation round 2, which is trying to get over 700 megawatts of green hydrogen produced. RWE has 2 projects in that, and that's using electrolysis to provide clean hydrogen to refineries, basically, or our project. So these are refineries that already use grey hydrogen, so dirty hydrogen, basically. And so we are basically decarbonizing them by providing green hydrogen. So those are coming. The technology is quite well known, the electrolysis technology. I think at scale, that's becoming a bit of a challenge. So RWE is building its first 100 megawatt one in Germany at the moment. So, you know, and you learn, you know, as batteries rolled out, you learn as you actually roll out big projects. But I think that's coming. I think there is some challenges with green hydrogen. The cost is still very high. So there needs to, and it's a bit like with batteries, right? It's a bit chicken and egg. The costs are high until you roll out a lot, and then you get economies of scale and the price will come down. So we have to see that actually happening in practice. And of course, there's some people who think it will and some people think it won't. I think you have to just actually start deploying it to see whether the cost comes down or not.
Okay. Yeah. As ever, when we think about these things that are new technologies, it's that sort of those first few data points that become so vital to working out whether this is going to be a smaller part of a really big system or whether this is going to be a really big thing. And from RWE's perspective, I think and the size of RWE, it makes total sense to sort of see and have access to that data and work out whether this is something you really want to roll out everywhere or whether this is something that's a smaller fraction.
I think that's right. Look, I'm sounding like the old man, but when I started the industry 25 years ago, I wouldn't have guessed where we'd get to today. So we're all going to be wrong, right? So what we know is in 25 years' time, you might still be working, I'll be retired. We'll all be looking back and going, oh, we didn't get that right. So you have to have little projects in every technology, and then you'll work out which one runs and which one doesn't.
Yeah, and I think that's a very natural kind of way of doing things in terms of small incremental stages of projects. Let's talk about one that's not a small incremental stage of project. Let's talk about one that's kind of a big switch in the GB power system. So moving us on to a debate on national or zonal pricing, which is a very big change. And I should just say it's the 4th of June today, and we are expecting a decision in Q2, and so by the time this airs, we could very well have a decision one way or the other. And so, just for context, so if someone's saying, "Well, why is Tom talking about that thing that was announced a month ago?" And we have talked about zonal and national at length as an industry, but also on this podcast as well. We've had sort of pro national, pro zonal people on. I think the thing I really wanted to get to with this is when that decision comes through, whichever kind of way it goes, I'm really interested to kind of understand how a group like RWE would try and make the most of it. So if we're in Reform National, which would be a change to today, or if we're in a zonal, how do you make the most of it?
Yeah, thanks. And just for the record, I am pro-national, but I'm more pro-decision now, right?
Okay.
Yeah, I still think zonal is not a good idea, but actually we need decisions, right? Because uncertainty is worse, and we might get on to what that means going forward. So how does RWE deal with it? Look, I mean, I think I'm going to sound relatively confident here. I mean, if you actually look where RWE's plants are, they're predominantly below the Midlands in the UK, right? Okay. So actually, from a zonal perspective, actually, we've got a lot of power stations in the south, and we have got some in the north. But if you actually look at it, what is roughly expected to happen is wholesale prices in the south will go up slightly, and wholesale prices in kind of above some kind of boundary, depending where you draw the zone, in the north will go down significantly. So actually, when you look on a wholesale price level, probably RWE is probably one of the better protected generators from that change. So I think that's maybe number one. We've always had our power stations towards the kind of Midlands to south, exactly because we thought that building power stations in the north was not the most clever idea. So maybe that's the first bit of risk management, is you try and set up your portfolio. You also set up your portfolio so it's balanced, right? So we do have a geographic spread. So we do have wind farms in the north of Scotland, and we do have all the way down to the south and in Wales and in East Anglia. So also having a geographic spread hopefully means that, what might win, what might lose, and you kind of hedge yourself that way. And then I think the other thing that we're now trying to do is obviously maybe on two fronts. One is encouraging the government to understand the protections that are required in order to keep investment low cost in the UK. So we are obviously working very hard with the rest of the industry to work with the government. So if they go with zonal, what are what we call the protection and grandfathering mechanisms that are put in place that will make our investments still able to be made? And importantly, able to be made at a very good price for consumers. So that's kind of what I call the protection package. Yeah. So that's one thing we're doing. The other thing we're doing is obviously big company like RWE, like all the other people in the market, we're doing lots and lots of modelling of what a zonal market could mean and what the prices could be, so that when we're doing investment decisions, we can put those into our investment decisions and work out, does it all still make sense? Yeah.
And you have a kind of almost a unique position, maybe not unique, that's not quite right, but RWE is active in lots of markets, right? So not all markets are national. So you have the ability to be able to say to groups in other markets, what have you seen in zonal markets, or even going even further in nodal markets? And you can kind of
even more than that. So my previous role was chief commercial officer for our global renewables business. So I've actually done investments in nodal and zonal markets.
Okay.
So I've actually, this is why it kind of, I must get a little bit frustrated with lots of people in the UK who have theoretically saying zonal are a good idea, but have never actually done investments there. I have done investments in those markets, and I can tell you they're not good.
They're not good. Okay.
From an investor perspective. And the reason for that, if I just really, really broadly explain how it feels to be an investor. So the problem with zonal or nodal markets is the price you get at your node or your zone is dependent on what the demand is near you, what other generators build near with you, and more importantly, what transmission lines are built away from you. Now, I have no control over either any of those three elements. I don't have a control over who builds near me. I don't have control of what demand gets located near me. And I definitely don't have any control over what lines get built near me. So basically, you're putting the risk with the person that can't control or influence any of those things. So therefore, they have to risk price them, right? So it's quite simple. You just go, it's uncertain. Investors hate uncertainty. They risk price them. And therefore, it ends up being more expensive, right? So that's the reason why investors don't like it in summary. And if I give you my experiences from the ERCOT market, so this is a nodal market. When I was the chief commercial officer, we sold two brand new 500 megawatt onshore wind farms, identical technologies, identically built. One had what we call a hub swap. So that is a swap that protects you off the nodal price to the hub, and one didn't. And therefore, and the same buyer bought them off us. And so you could back calculate effectively the discount rate that they applied for the one with the nodal price risk. And it was over 300 basis points higher.
Okay.
Right? And if you look at all the analysis of anybody done, if you get more than 50 basis points move on the WACC, so on the weighted average cost of capital, benefits of zonal disappear. And so that's effectively real life experience in a real market. And I get the pro zonal people say, well, it won't stop investment. I agree. I've never said zonal would stop investment. It just increases the cost of investment, which effectively is no good for consumers.
Mm. But in that example you were describing, you're really saying, well, look, if you can actually hedge this properly, so you can have an ability to take your price back to hub,
yep,
then actually you can deal with that risk. Was that essentially what you were saying?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So if you had what's called financial transmission rights, which are basically hedges, which basically swap you out, then indeed you can get rid of that risk.
Okay.
The problem was the practical experience around the world is FTRs, as they're called, financial transmission rights, have only ever been offered by ESOs for about 3 years. But it takes me more or less 3 years to even build the power station. So it's not a hedge for my 30-year lifetime. So it's kind of theoretical when people talk about these kind of hedges. They don't really exist in the real world.
When you say ESO, you mean the electricity system operator the various regions.
So normally in most markets that have a zonal or nodal market, the system operator offers out these financial transmission rights to try and help investors hedge.
Okay.
But obviously that's them taking financial risk.
Yeah.
And so therefore they normally theoretically talk about it at the beginning, but when their risk committees work out the risk, they end up not offering them out.
Okay.
So it's like a theoretical thing you can help you, but in reality we don't actually see it happening in real markets.
Okay. And I think that's really that sort of if the decision is made, and apologies if the decision is made and this is coming out after then, but I think a lot of the debate that's going to happen in GB over the coming months will be around, okay, if we do go to a zonal market, like how do we deal with things like financial transmission rights? How do we make sure that we do the grandfathering correctly so that investment both for wind or storage is kept happy and keeps on moving through? I think it would be remiss of me to not sort of offer the side. So you were mentioning that investors find it difficult in a zonal market. I think if I were to read some of the zonal side and say, well, why are they thinking about this? They would think much more from a cost to consumer perspective. And so there is a balance here between the right thing for investors and what is perceived to be the right thing for consumers. And to your point on cost of capital, if cost of capital is much higher, then that has a bad impact on consumers. But also if that higher cost of capital doesn't necessarily materialize because things are well managed in the transition, then perhaps you could end up with a world where the cost to consumers is lower. and a risk of kind of going down the rabbit hole of zonal, just that's kind of the things that people are thinking about in terms of this debate. I think we have got to a good point to leave national versus zonal.
I think
zonal.
That's a jolly good idea.
To actually ask the question then in another way. So if for your point of view, that shift is not worth the effort, How do we reduce costs for consumers in GB?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's absolutely critical. I mean, the absolutely simplest way, right, is if you look at all the net zero technologies, whether they're batteries, renewables, nuclear, whatever, they're all upfront capital technologies, right? And so the biggest lever you have is to get that cost of capital down. So if you look at any modeling, that's the way you do it. And to get cost of capital down, you need to make all the investments as riskless as possible. Right, so there should be an absolute focus by the government to say, how do I make investors go into these technologies at the least risk possible? So that's kind of like the overall macro thing they should be considering of. Because if I've got my next probably offshore wind farm is $3 billion just for one project. So if I can get the cost of capital down on that, it's all up front. The amount it reduces electricity prices by under the CFD is huge. So that's the first thing to say. Then some more practical stuff. What can you do? So one thing we've talked about is lengthening the tenor of the contract for difference. So that's the contract we get to secure our revenues for our renewable assets. So the moment it's set at 15 years, but the lifetime of our assets now more like 30 years. So we're only securing 15 years of it, and the rest of it, the last 15 years, I've got to take merchant risk, decide whether I've got zonal pricing or what I've got. So I'm risk pricing that quite heavily. So the longer you make that CFD, the lower the prices. And I'm absolutely convinced that if you lengthen CFD, say, to 25 years, which is more like the international standard now, the reduction in bills will be higher than what you'd get under the theoretical reduction under zonal. And it would take one stroke of a pen as opposed to disrupting a whole industry for 5 years. So that's one answer. The second one, which is the more controversial one, and Energy UK, which I sit on the board of, have done a good paper on this. So I would also point your listener to that for a much better explanation. The other one is actually, we've got a problem with electricity bills at the moment where we don't really have the principle that polluter pays. So all the levies of being clean sit on the people who are being clean, as in using electricity. And those who are continuing to use fossil fuels, like gas, aren't getting taxed for cleaning themselves up. So we don't have the incentive to move from gas to electricity naturally in the market. Electricity wholesale prices are still above the magic 3x, as I call it. So ideally, you want electricity prices to be maximum 2.5x higher than gas prices. And just for the listeners, why is that? That's because it's roughly the efficiency of a heat pump. So if you want people to change from a gas boiler to a heat pump, you need to get that ratio of gas to electricity right. So it's a no-brainer to put a heat pump in. But the gas people aren't really paying for their emissions at the moment. Now, I think it's too controversial and potentially too regressive to just put those levies onto gas, because unfortunately there's a whole part of society who maybe can't afford to insulate and put and change from gas heating. So I think you're looking at maybe trying to put into taxation, which of course is very controversial, given the government, of course, with its current spending issues, can't really put up tax. But I think that's another way of really doing it and making sure it's a progressive energy system.
Yeah, and I think that's something that is really important, because definitely in terms of our modeling, we've definitely found that we see both in the market today, but we also see in many future periods a lot of negative pricing coming through. And that's quite an odd concept, particularly around like contracts for difference, because in your contracts for difference, you might have a strike price that's say £70 and you get paid that £70 unless that day ahead price, which is called the reference price, goes to a negative number. And so sometimes if we don't have enough demand on the system, we can get these kind of phenomenons where more negative pricing comes in. And then you've got your, I'm going to forget the number you said earlier, but let's say £3 billion that you're investing into wind, and that kit's sort of not generating, even though it's windy. And really focusing on getting more demand on the system is really critical for this thing working well.
Yeah, absolutely. More smart demand, right?
More smart demand.
So that's probably what I'm going to say. To get consumer bells, we do need to just finally start this smart metering, right? And all our modelling shows that we do need all these heat pumps, all these EVs, all the home batteries, all interacting in the system in order to make all this manageable. So we make some quite robust assumptions on what that's going to look like on the demand side. We need all this EV demand to move. We need all the heat pumps to move. We need the home batteries and the home solar. But we still need all this wholesale stuff as well. And, you know, the big problem at the moment is, of course, we're still not getting smart metering into the home. We're still not getting the policies right on the demand side. And I think you're fully right. And one of our big concerns, if you look at the Clean Power Plan, which is the government's plan for 2030, it's very supply focused. And actually, by 2030, they assume hardly any increase in demand, maybe like 10 terawatt hours. But they're generating a load more electricity with twice as many infrastructure. So the risk we've got by not encouraging demand is we invest twice as much on the supply side. So the pounds doubles, if you like, in my pound per megawatt hour, but the megawatt hour remains the same. And yet we still want to end up with a cheaper bill. So from our perspective, we would vastly really encourage the government to look at even more demand side, more flexible demand side, but just more demand side generally.
Yes, and particularly that transition away from gas to power.
Exactly, yes.
Okay, good. And then let's move on from reducing the cost to consumer, or perhaps, I mean, this is very much linked, but the power system, as we get into the future periods, you talked earlier about how there'll be a 2 or 3 week period where you might have to rely on gas. But in that winter period that you're describing, the thing that you would lean on, if not gas, would be, say, wind generation. Wind has had a bit of an up and down few years in terms of costs increasing within the supply chain. And particularly, we had an allocation round of CFDs where it didn't clear because the price was set too low, the cap was set too low. How do we get wind back on a track to be a really successful part of producing energy into the GB power system?
Yeah, and we probably need to, like, first of all, split between onshore wind and offshore wind. So Onshore wind was successful in the last CFDs and is rolling out fine on the onshore side. The big challenge is to do more in England and in Wales, actually. So we've still got most of the onshore wind being done in Scotland, which maybe, as we kind of hinted earlier, for those listeners who aren't kind of, if they, you know, you don't really want that much more generation in Scotland, right? Because of the amount of transmission required. You want more in England. And one of the big things we've seen in terms of a positive development on the onshore side is obviously now we can do onshore wind in England, which was obviously a bit of a moratorium for the last 10 years. But it will take a long time for those projects to come to fruition. But I would say onshore wind continuing to roll out. It can be competitive in the right location versus solar. It has a different profile. And as more solar comes on the system, the capture price for solar will become more challenging. And having a portfolio of onshore wind will also be very good. So that's kind of easier. I think the headwinds, I think you're really talking about in the offshore sector. And look, it is a challenging environment now. And as you said, we effectively have had three failures of auctions for offshore wind because we had AR4, which then the project had to rebid in. We had complete non-success in AR5. AR6, we've obviously unfortunately had the very sad news of the Ørsted Hornsea projects of not going ahead, which I'm sure must have been a very tough decision for them. So actually, we've been procuring less than a gigawatt a year of offshore wind, and yet the Clean Power Plan says we probably need 7 to 8 gigawatts. So that's tough. And if I kind of like maybe split the discussion into maybe two, one is like the global headwinds that are in the market, and then maybe the local ones. So globally, look, the supply chain has been squeezed. It was very clear the OEMs weren't making money, and so they had to adjust their prices in order to have a sustainable business model. So they've adjusted that. We've also had, so that's what puts pressure on supply chain. We've obviously had globally a lot of people wanting to deploy this kind of technology. So generally supply chain, whether that be wires, whether it be offshore platforms, transformers, commodity prices generally have all gone up in prices. So we've had globally prices going up. And then we've also had what I call the kind of the risk-off investor issue, which is what we're seeing is investors are becoming a lot more value-focused and a bit less ESG-focused. So generally their investment discipline, I mean, we would always say at RW we've had strict investment discipline, but generally speaking, the investors are requiring us to all increase our returns. So these are like global headwinds that means the cost of offshore wind is going up. And we don't currently see that changing.
There's also a cost of capital point to your earlier piece around how important the cost of capital is, and that we're now in a 5% type period, whereas if we go back, say, 6-7 years, the cost of capital was significantly lower.
Just to be clear on that 5%, so you can put money in risk-free UK government bonds, treasury bonds, for 10 years and get 4.3%, right? A few years ago, it was like almost zero, right? So if investors can put it risk-free at 4.whatever%, then for any debt, they now want 6% plus. So for equity, they want 10% plus, right? So you're, so that just drives the whole market in
another
terms of,
part of a headwind.
It's a headwind, right? But if you look at, even with those price things, up to a certain amount of penetration, it's still absolutely clear that offshore wind is required, and it's one of the cheaper technologies to get to net zero. So it's still required, right? So I think we've got to kind of take, those are global headwinds, but we all still realize, and we can have a discussion about, is it 50 gigawatts, 60 gigawatts, 80 gigawatts? And I think that's a reasonable discussion, because at some point it becomes over-penetrated, but we're way off that level. So we all agree offshore wind is required despite those headwinds. So now we just need to work out how to make it cheap to deploy in the UK. And then I look at the UK specific headwinds, and this is, as the government, what I spend a lot of time saying to them, look, you can't sort the global headwinds, but you can sort out the UK ones. It's effectively the same. To invest in the UK, you just need to make it more attractive than Germany, Netherlands, USA, right? You don't need to make any more than that. So the government needs to have absolute strict focus on making the UK the most investable place. And the way you do that is policy certainty, best auctions, simple. Yeah, keep it really simple. And, you know, one of the, whether it be zonal pricing, whether it would be the kind of supply chain issues we now got to deal with, redesign the auctions again, redesign the CFD again, changes to our transmission charging, etc. All these things are unnecessary, right? So it's kind of like we kind of, there's the bit we can't help, but we're still managing to make a little bit of a meal of the stuff we can help. So my view is we need to make those decisions, and we won't go back into which one is the right one, but you need to make decisions and make them quickly, give investors certainty, and then the cost of capital will be as low as possible, and we'll be able to deliver those wind farms as quickly and as cheaply as possible for the consumer.
And if I can pull out just one thing, I know we have kind of closed that box, but I just want to bring out one sort of element on that location, because you mentioned it on terms of having more onshore wind in England and Wales.
Yep.
There's also a slight problem that you can get, say, a wind farm that's on the very north end of Scotland, and then it can be expensive to build transmission, and oftentimes that transmission can be constrained. And so you might not be able to get the full benefit of that wind farm in Scotland down into demand, whether that's in Scotland or England. So how would you tweak the way that CFDs work today to try and achieve that goal that you want, which is perhaps less at the very north tip of Scotland and perhaps more in England and Wales?
Yeah, I mean, unbelievably, we've been solving this issue for at least 30 years in the energy system. So we have something called transmission network use of system charges in the UK. And even today, it costs you £40 a kilowatt per year to connect in the north of Scotland, and you get paid to connect in the south. So there was already a huge disbenefit for connecting in Scotland. We don't need zonal prices to do that. We've already got locational transmission signals under an existing system. So my tweak would be, that is actually not harsh enough. If you actually updated that model, so you just took the current model and just updated it with current parameters, and you factored in the full cost of what we call the bootstrap. So these are the big transmission lines we're going to have to build from Scotland down to England. Then actually the price in Scotland should be £100 per kilowatt per annum, which is much higher than what most people forecast zonal prices. So our view is you should update the transmission charging so that people connecting in Scotland see the full network infrastructure cost of their decisions. And you may actually still find that it makes economic sense. We've actually, one of our latest FIDs was indeed an onshore Scottish wind farm in the north of Scotland. And even considering our view of where transmission charges could go, it was still more economic than a solar plant in the south, because of capture prices and lots of other complicated reasons. But I think you just need to update the current transmission charging to make sure there's a very sharp signal about where to put your power stations, but one that's more investable because it's more, less variable, more fixed, et cetera, et cetera.
I think that for listeners, I really hope they're getting a sense of some of the really big and challenging and multifaceted things that are being considered, the knock-on effects of them, but also how people within the industry are really thinking about them. And I think we could talk for way longer on this, but I will move us on to our final two questions.
Good.
That's
enough zonal for anybody.
Yeah. Is there anything you'd like to plug?
You know, we talked a lot about energy bills and the problem for consumers. And I think all of us within the energy industry all know that all these grand plans, all these investment stuffs will come unhinged if we don't get down consumer costs, and particularly those who are struggling. So I would make a plug for anybody listening, if they do have a spare 5 minutes, to go onto the Fuel Bank Foundation website and make a donation.
Okay. I love it. And we'll put a link into the show notes as well so that people can find their way
there.
Thank
you, yeah.
And then my final question is there anything that you believe that is a contrarian view? So something you believe that the majority of the market doesn't?
I don't know if it's contrarian from the majority of the market. It might be contrarian from government policy. So let's maybe put it like that. And maybe lots of your listeners will ring in and go, we agree, hopefully. So if I go back a few years, we were all absolutely convinced we all needed better planning and more strategic planning for the energy system, right? So I remember I did a speech about 3 to 5 years ago and I made this point, we need more strategic planning. Okay, and now we seem to have kind of gone on to people talk about a system architect. And, you know, an architect tends to be quite detailed plans, right? As opposed to a strategic planner, which tends to be more strategy. And it does feel to me that we're going really detailed. So if you look at like the Clean Power Plan 2030, it talks about, and the action plan, it talks about how many megawatts of what technology in which zone. Yeah, and then that's going to feed into the connection plan. And we're going to say, well, that's how many megawatts in each place we're going to have. That is really detailed. And as we have said earlier in the podcast, we'll all get it wrong, right? I guarantee you what actually happens in 10 years will be completely different to what we all forecast. So one mind deciding that this is the way we're going to go, I really worry that we'll either not invest in the right things or it'll be too expensive. We're not allowing, so in my view, we're not allowing the market. I still believe the market has a role. Maybe in a dim distant history, I used to work at Enron, so maybe people shouldn't take my advice. But I do think the market should have a role where possible in order to get consumers down. So I do think we need to, when we all ask for strategic plans, we need to take a step back now and say, have we gone a bit too far? Or, well, I believe we have, in terms of architecture and detail design. And how do we get the market to still work in this? And this is why I'm still kind of a believer of, we still need competition within areas. We still need clear signals. We still need auctions that have enough technologies and enough geographic diversity in there and different technologies. You know, we could have a long debate about what role batteries are going to have versus hydrogen generators versus gas, and we'll all be wrong, but the wisdom of the market will work out who's right. Yeah. And I think that would be my kind of like key takeaway of where I sit there as the old grumpy man now of the electricity industry, kind of take a step back and go, did we really want this level of detailed planning? And is that going to end up to the right way to bring the system forward in a competitive way?
Okay, I'm going to extend this question by one more. So we had Julian Leslie, who is the chief engineer, amongst other roles, from NESO on. And that podcast is actually released tomorrow. And he was talking about the Strategic Spatial Energy Plan, which people call SSEP. And I asked, this is bad because this puts me in, we're both in the sort of the grumpy old man role here of like challenging these things and saying, well, look, is that actually going to be the way it comes through? And I said exactly that. I said, well, look, what happens if you say you're going to build a transmission line that's going to enable 5 gigawatts of, say, electrolysis in this part of the country? What happens if, as of tomorrow, you say, oh God, electrolysis, that didn't kind of work out how we thought. And what do we now do with that sort of 5 gigawatts of transmission that we've built? And I think the general view was that a lot of the decisions being made from an architectural perspective are no regret. And so if the connection's there, then the technology will come in some form. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I actually agree with that bit a little bit more than I would have expected you when you introduced the question. So I'm a bit, I was a bit perplexed about the way we look at broadband versus electricity. So like for broadband, we just all agreed everybody needed broadband, right? And so you rolled out streets at a time to super fast broadband, and it didn't matter if the house had an 8-year-old who was, you know, only maybe use the mobile phone, or whether it was somebody who had got 3 people working at home with 3 kids like mine, or 2 kids like mine using computers too often. You just rolled everybody out to this standard on an expectation that everybody at some point will want super fast broadband. Bearing in mind electricity is even more existential, if you like. Why aren't we doing that everywhere? Like, why aren't we rolling out our whole electricity network to assume everybody has an EV, a heat pump, a solar and a battery? Right. And therefore, I do actually agree that building more transmission and more distribution is a kind of a no regret. Right. So that part of it, I'm kind of in agreement with. I think where I kind of struggle a little bit is things like connection queues, where you're deciding which technology in which order and which maturity connects in which order. Yeah, with no competition between it. So, you know, you could have a 50 megawatt solar on a north facing slope and a 50 megawatt one a week later on a south facing slope, and the north facing one will win according to the ESO. I mean, that is, to me, where you're not allowed in the market and you should allow the market to trade between those connections. The southern one would pay a lot more for the connection than the northerly one. As an example, you're not allowing smartness in terms of hybrid connections. So the ordering is like solar or battery or wind, but like no recognition for hybrid solutions. A lot of the queues assume that you're going to have, you know, 5 gigawatts of solar, 5 gigawatts of battery. So I think the bit they're doing on getting the transmission and distribution to invest, I kind of agree. It's almost like build the wires and they shall come. If you built it for electrolysis and electrolysis doesn't happen, I'm sure some data centers will put themselves at the end, or I'll put a battery there or something. So I'm kind of with them on the wires. In fact, I would go even more faster. Modernizing the society requires us to build a lot of wires, and we just need to kind of get over it a bit.
And get it done.
But that's kind of different. I'm talking about competition on what generators connect into that. And actually, we've got an evolving issue on the demand side, where all the issues we've had on generation, where we've all kind of, we've had this rush, haven't we, of the, how many is it now? 600, 700 gigawatts of connections that need sorting, because everybody realized the value was in the connections. Mm. It's really interesting. We're now seeing that on the demand side, that everybody is now hoovered up demand connections, because they've all realized if they want to build a data center or a battery or a electrifier, they need the demand connections. So now the rush is on demand connections. But that's slowing down our whole modernization of our economy, isn't it? So the wires and the connections, I would be really aggressive on it personally, because I just believe in electrification, and this is the future as much as broadband is.
Tom, you've been a fantastic guest. We're going to have to wrap it up there on time, but that was a brilliant overview of what is going on within the market, some of the critical points of the debate, and I think listeners will have a really informed view of some of the nuance that's going on within the energy market. So thank you.
Thank you for having me, and apologies about the stuff on Zonal.